touching hand, reaching out, touching me, touching you. Okay, welcome to another episode of Tarpon World Radio. This is your host, Barry Baruti, and today I'm joined with Robert Lugowitz from Fish and Frank. Say hi, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
Today, we are going to be talking about, that's Robert in his classic form, very literal.
Gotta have fun, it breaks it up. Well, I mean, I also wasn't expecting that music for the play, but that's all good.
You gotta play some Neil Diamond, some Sweet Caroline,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's a good song.
That might be what we tag our next shark and call it, Neil Diamond, or Sweet Caroline, actually.
I think Neil Diamond would be a good one.
That would be
good. I think there is a Caroline already.
Actually, yes. We need to send that to OSearch and tell them Sweet Caroline should be the next one.
There you go.
Why make it all about the ones we tag? Let's tag a white shark that size.
Nice. Perfect.
So, as you can tell, we're going to be talking about sharks today, and specifically their migrations through the southwest region of Florida, which is where we are located, in the Charlotte Harbor, Pine Island, Boca Grande area. So first off, I want to start off with Robert here. And Robert, when did you first, like, fall in love with sharks?
Oh, geez. Probably when I was a teenager, honestly, watching them catch them. You know, I used to watch all the fishing shows on, back then it was ESPN, actually had their ESPN Outdoors section every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And I just enjoyed watching that, but probably my first real fond memory of it was like Jacques Cousteau when I was a real little kid, you know, and they fascinated and scared me all at the same time. But I think when I really got involved in the catching of them and the wanting to gain more knowledge about them was right shortly after I started working here a little over 20 years ago.
Wow. Okay. And like when you were watching those shows as a kid on ESPN, well, specifically because I used to watch those shows growing up as well, what was like your favorite show, or like which one like stuck out to you the most, and like what shark were they targeting?
Geez, I can't even remember the name of some of those shows, to be honest with you. I mean, I remember Mark Sosin's Saltwater Journal was one of them that was fairly popular back then.
There was the Spanish Fly with Jose.
The Spanish Fly was always awesome. I think it would have either been the Spanish Fly or Mark Sosin, you know,
yeah,
as far as them catching some... You know what, actually? It was actually Flip Pallet.
Well, I was going to say that Flip was
It was Flip Pallet because he was in the Bahamas, and he was bone fishing and came across a couple of small lemon sharks on a flat, mm-hmm, and got them to chase his fly. Uh-huh. And it just shocked me that you could actually get a shark to chase an artificial, because, you know, I mean, I was probably 12, 14 years old, maybe 15 tops, I don't know. So, mm-hmm, we're talking 30 plus years ago.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying. So to see that, because I always associated sharks with eating fish, you know, you had to chum the water with blood, and, you know, it was the stereotypical Jaws kind of thing that you associated with shark fishing. So to see these little 3 to 4 foot lemon sharks chasing after just a regular little bonefish fly, essentially, or he might have switched over to a streamer fly for him, I'm not sure, but it shocked me. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that kind of made me more intrigued as far as the different ways to maybe fish for them and think a little bit more outside of the box.
Not just your typical huge hook, big hunk of meat, and a chain or something, and tie it to a dock.
Exactly.
And wait to see what happens. You can do it in a fun, sporty way on fly, which is, like you said, back in those days was unheard of.
Unheard of, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. So, you know, since then it's like... You know, and I've learned so much over the years, different little tricks, because when I first started doing it here, it was heavy, heavy tackle, long leader, you know, for all of what you thought might be bigger sharks. Mm-hmm. And then for like the bonnet heads, you know, it was always smaller hooks, smaller tackle, but everything in between was usually big stuff.
Yes.
And I've just, you know, fine-tuned it over the years, and, You know, anytime I get really fascinated with something, I've always tried to learn about as much of the biology of it as right. I possibly can, just to broaden my knowledge, basically. And in doing so, it also made me a better fisherman for some of those species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you understand their habits, what they like to, when you say the biology, their feeding patterns or mating patterns, what feeding, they like to eat.
Yeah.
I mean,
times and places when they are around, when to expect them, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
You know, get their whole biological clock going, so you know, like, this is the time of year when this species is probably usually going to show up, and why is it going to show up, and is it going to feed on this or that, or
is it just more focused on mating? Like, what is the reason they're there exactly?
Yeah, exactly.
It cuts down a lot of time of just year-round fishing for them when they could not even be there, period.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, going into something blind is always tricky. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's been fun, you know, and I've gotten to learn a lot and been taught so much over the years, talking to everyday anglers, biologists. Probably one of the best books, you know, as far as reading goes, that actually made me a little bit better shark fisherman in general. There's two really good books, but one in particular.
Uh-huh.
You name one.
I think, oh man, this book I know was written in the 70s. I own it. It's the guy who like set the record for the great white, right?
He didn't get credit for it.
Okay.
Because he supposedly caught it
on a whale carcass.
He used whale meat.
Whale meat, which was like
not taboo. Allowed in. Well, it's not allowed in IGFA.
There we go.
No mammal meat. You know, he could have still done whatever he was doing. But it was a gray area. But that was Frank Mundus. Sport Fishing for Sharks is one of them.
Okay.
But the first book I ever read where it gave me a whole lot of knowledge on how fish act or react to things was Eugenia Clark, The Lady and the Sharks.
Right.
She was the founder of the original Moat Marine Laboratory, which at that time was called the Cape Hayes Laboratory, because it was right here in Lemon Bay.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, it was just north of the Gasparilla Causeway, the original Moat Marine Cape Hayes Laboratory in the late 60s.
Wow. I had no idea of that. That's something new for me.
And you got to read the book.
Yeah, I didn't know about that book
it's
either.
It's called The Lady and the Sharks. It's killer. I mean, it gives you some really neat, and she talks about going just outside of Gasparilla Pass and out of Stump Pass at the time, catching sand tigers. On a regular basis.
Sand tigers?
Mm-hmm. Which nobody catches sand tigers here anymore.
But aren't those cold water sharks typically?
They generally catch them from Jacksonville North on a regular basis on the Atlantic side.
What were they doing
here? They were common here. They used to be common here at a time.
Back in the 60s, right?
60s that's, and 70s.
That's not too long.
No.
That's not too long ago.
So what's changed?
Right.
Was it overfishing? Could it be climate change, water temperature, pollutants? I mean, there's a million different possibilities, but nobody ever really talks about it. But I mean, even nobody associates a blue shark with the Gulf of Mexico, and yet they do exist up in the Texas area, blue sharks. But we had a guy catch one about 5 years ago off of Inglewood Beach, about 2 miles out. I saw the video.
Wow.
Like a 7-footer.
Jeez, those anomalies just make
He was in, I think he was 20 feet of water off of Inglewood Beach. And you've caught plenty of sharks land-based fishing up there off of Inglewood area.
Yeah.
And you caught a nice blue shark. I was stunned.
Wow.
So there's always those weird little things, but you would dig that read.
Yeah. And is it more about, and what's the biggest takeaway you've got from that book? Just the history of what used to be in this area, or is she also described the biology?
She describes the biology and their feeding habits.
Like, oh my gosh, yeah, I have to pick that up.
What have we talked about with when a shark comes up to eat a bait? What do they usually do?
You mean other than sniffing it and
yeah,
nudge it with their nose a little bit?
Most of the time, and I might have this backwards, so forgive me, but
okay. When
they come up to actually grab the bait, they almost come at it from a clockwise pattern.
Okay.
To grab the bait. They might circle it in a counterclockwise or clockwise or whatever, but when they actually come to grab it, it's clockwise.
They come from the right side. See, I've seen them do the circle back on a bait counterclockwise on a left circle, but
right, but most of the time if they come around it and circle it this way or that way, they'll circle back around it and come up on it from a counter. I think it's a clockwise position.
Was that in the book?
Yeah,
because
she talks about keeping these sharks in pins.
Uh-huh.
and setting baits out and watching them with that, but also setting out a triangle box, a rectangle box, and a circle box, and letting them find the food, or to get fed, they knew that they would have to hit this particular box.
Wow.
You know, and she'd switch them in different patterns, so if they came up and hit the right box, she would feed them.
Mm-hmm.
So they could learn certain different little behaviors and stuff like that. But that coolest part about that, it's off the subject, but also in the same subject, that same pattern, and I think it's clockwise.
Okay.
Tarpon do the exact same thing when they're daisy chaining. If you got a school of tarpon that are daisy chaining in a clockwise position, most of the time you can get one of those fish to eat. If they're in a counterclockwise daisy chain, most of the time won't eat.
Because they're in the wrong position. They don't feed from that side.
I don't know.
I've got to pay attention to the daisy chaining thing.
You'll have to read it, because I'm not sure. I might have it reversed.
Okay.
It's either clockwise or counterclockwise, but it was pretty cool because watching the sharks do that, because I especially watch it with hammerheads, catching them here and mm-hmm. sight fishing them with baits, to watch them come up and do that, and it was 8 out of 10 times.
Wow. So it's like you can read, basically what you're saying is you can read the body language of a shark and tell if he's going to feed or not, or if he's just like kind of investigating a bait, or just kind of like just curious.
Right. And it's kind of like the aggressiveness of a shark. They'll lower their pec fins down, you know.
Yes.
They've documented that many times when you know it's getting into an aggressive mode. You know, it's another one of those just observation kind of things.
Wow. That's deep. That's like, that's a whole other level of understanding sharks right
it's
there.
It's just fun, though.
Yeah, it is, you know, fun to know.
And to be able to apply it to make yourself a better fisherman. It's like you can say, okay, he's circling that way. Oh, he's circling this way. He's getting ready to take the bait.
Right,
now.
He just turned. He's going to, yeah.
Wow. You know, just weird.
That blows my mind. I don't think I've ever discussed that with you or ever heard that before, really. Wow.
We might have, but we've talked about so much stuff over the years, I've forgotten half of the conversations we've had just because we have some pretty cool conversations, you and I.
Yeah.
You're one of the few that wants to learn not just how to catch shark, because anyone can go out and figure out a rig and customize their own way to go out and try to catch a shark.
Yeah.
But you've always wanted to learn more deeply about them.
Right. Especially with, like, it just becomes fun when you can pattern, especially in this area, when you can pattern sharks and know typically on which full moon what shark is leaving, or it could be a new moon as well, which ones are leaving and which ones are coming in during different times of the year, because
right.
there's always sharks available to catch.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fun. It just becomes, calculated, which is, I love that. When
yeah.
you can calculate your moves, you know what fish is going to be around, what bait to use,
right.
what hooks to use, because different sharks have different, you know, thicknesses of their lips, and
right.
I've used primarily circle hooks, or that's all I use for sharks.
Right.
And it's a whole systematic process, at least for
right.
me. That's why it's enjoyable.
Well, and you can narrow it down, because like you said, there's sharks here year-round, but the reality is that, okay, there's always a bull shark here throughout the whole year. There's always a hammerhead or a lemon, or any of our large coastal species of sharks are always here year-round. But to say you're going to go out and target, let's say, a bull shark
mm-hmm.
in January, you know, because customers come in a shop and they come to Florida and they want to catch a shark.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go catch a great big bull shark. Where can I go to catch a bull shark? And it's February. I'll tell them Key West.
Yeah.
You're not going to catch it here realistically.
Right.
You could go out there and drift all day and not get a bite, because you're only dealing with a couple of fish that are in the entire several hundred square miles of Charlotte Harbor.
Yes.
Versus in April, May, and June, when they show up in great numbers, now you stand a much, much more practical chance
of
catching those species, because they show up here for that time of year, because like all other fish, they are seasonal.
Right.
You know, you can catch a striper any time of the year in New York,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but to do it in great numbers, it's a summertime thing into the early fall.
Exactly.
Same concept.
I was going to say, let's stick with bull sharks, because I'm kind of fascinated with bull sharks, because growing up on the harbor and fishing majority of my life growing up in the harbor,
mm-hmm.
I started off with little bull sharks.
Right.
Bull sharks are so plentiful in the harbor. It's like they always get up to that certain size, and then once they reach about 5.5-6 foot, you don't catch them any bigger in
not
the harbor.
Not as often, not as consistently.
Exactly. Not as consistently as you do as like the 2.5 footers all the way to 4, 4.5. That's like the average size in the
Correct.
Harbor of these bull sharks. So you know, the curious part of me is like, man, when they get bigger, I'm sure they're going oceanside. They're leaving this estuary of the Charlotte Harbor.
Right.
So what do you think happens to, like, not what happens, but do they just stay here for a couple years until they become of size and they head straight to the ocean? Or do they go from the upper harbor to maybe, like, let's say Pine Island or more of the salt water, but still stay close to land before they take off? What are your opinions?
I think they do stay more close to shore when they're in that smaller size because they are part of the food chain, you know, because all sharks are cannibalistic.
Yes.
You know, they eat each other, and same species, it doesn't matter. You know, if they think they can get it in their mouth, they're going to eat it.
Yes.
So I think your smaller sharks do stay closer to shore, mm-hmm. and along the intercoastals where they have a little bit shallower water, a little bit more protected habitat. Mm-hmm. To stay away from the large predators such as the bigger sharks.
Whether it be a different species or the same species.
Yeah. Well, the only thing that I think is a little bit of the exception to that might be hammerheads.
Right.
Because you almost never see little hammerheads or medium-sized hammerheads because you go offshore throughout the year grouper fishing. And you could have a 6 foot come up to you or a 12 foot come up to you.
Yes.
So they're a little different, but I think I honestly don't have a really definitive answer on that one.
That's interesting. Bull sharks, I just know that there's just so many, and it's just interesting to see how.
Well, bull sharks like a great white to everybody because everybody in the world recognizes three sharks.
Uh huh.
The great white being number one.
Yes.
A hammerhead being number two as far as recognition.
Yep.
But as far as name recognition, great white, bull shark, then hammerhead because...
Right. Great white is because of the movie Jaws and what you see on Shark Week all the time. Mm-hmm. Air Jaws and all of that. But bull sharks, I know that comes up a lot because, at least from my opinion, my standpoint is that's the number one shark that's associated with shark attacks.
Shark attacks, it's found worldwide and can live in 100% fresh water.
Exactly.
So that makes it a very intimidating shark, and especially since it is responsible for more shark attacks. And probably, I don't know necessarily about deaths because great whites are so large. Usually when they attack somebody, the person bleeds out.
Exactly. It's just one bite and they're... Yeah.
So, but bull sharks have just that serious reputation for themselves. And if I'm not mistaken, the male bull shark actually has a higher testosterone level than... male elephant in heat.
Yes.
So that makes them super unpredictable on top of that.
Yes. That's the one good thing I'm, like, grateful for with a bull shark is they're called, at least the way I see them, they're bull sharks because they're so top heavy. Mm-hmm. They're kind of like a, if you want to think of like a big bull, you know, cow, they're so top heavy that when you, for instance, have them on dry land, or not dry land, but on the beach or something.
In shallower water, under control.
Under control. They're not as flexible. Think of them like as a big bodybuilder. They can't really go down and tie their shoelaces, or in this case, touch their tail with their mouth.
Right.
So you're somewhat relatively safe around them. But if they were that aggressive and they were that flexible, like a lemon shark.
Right.
Lemon shark can, it doesn't matter the length, they can reach around and grab their own tail with their mouth. So
in a second.
Right.
Like a split second.
You are never safe around a lemon shark. There's no safe place to be. So, like, that's why I'm glad the one that has the highest testosterone levels are actually, like, stocky, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But,
because that would make them a very, very difficult fish to handle with relative safety, with whether you're from boat or land or pier, you know, it's still, that one's one of the little bit more easier to deal with sharks.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. Jeez. Yeah. So, and then what about, what's your take on tiger sharks? Are they that frequent here?
Right. No, I mean, only in the last 5 years they've become a little bit more common.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it's some of it's become a little bit more common. But I think some of it has also become, in the last 5 years, we've seen a pretty big change in anglers going out and specifically targeting sharks at beaches and near shore reefs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the main biggest thing that has changed with that is social media. almost 90%, without knowing the real statistic and just pulling a number out of my air, I'd say 95% of the population that has a cell phone has some type of smartphone which has a camera on it. Mm-hmm. So they're able to take a picture of it, either whether they have Facebook or Instagram or any of that stuff, they may not have that, but they are able to send that picture to their friend who then shares it with another friend. So it goes out very rapidly.
Exactly.
And so we hear about them a lot more often nowadays rather than 8-10 years ago. You only heard of a couple here or there. And I think it's just because it was such a small niche group of guys that were shark fishing that would say, yeah, I caught a tiger shark and this is the only guy I can tell it to because he's going to appreciate it. Well, who's he going to share it with? You know, it's like you and I have had some great shark fishing experiences on our own, but you're one of the few I can actually share it with that's going to really appreciate it.
Of course, yeah.
And take it to heart or just show your enthusiasm or excitement for a catch that I've caught or vice versa. Mm-hmm. Versus you tell it to someone else who's an extreme snook fisherman, he's going to go, oh, that's awesome. That's great. Well, I caught this 40-inch snook the other day and on to the next thing. And who's he going to share it with? Because it's not going to come up with his conversation with any of his circle because he's a snook fisherman.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, so it's just it was a much slower process of getting that information around. Mm. And I think a little bit of it when we saw a spike in it was actually right within probably a year or two after the oil spill up there.
Oh, you think
Louisiana.
That's when you saw more. That's about 5 years ago when you started.
5-7 years ago, something. I'm not even sure. I can't even keep track of dates anymore.
Right. That's around that range when you said they started becoming more prevalent.
Yeah. We started to see a few more catches of them. You know, so I don't know if that maybe also played a role with pushing some of those animals further south to follow either a food source or escape maybe some of the pollutants there. I'm not really sure.
Right, because isn't some of the oil still on the bottom?
Yeah.
They sunk it.
Yeah, they put that chemical on it that sank it to the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just a theory.
Right, yeah.
You know, there's nothing really to it other than coincidence. But I think the main thing is, you know, social media. Yeah. It's just so much easier. All that stuff of instant gratification is out there quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that kid that caught that Mako last year just outside of Boca, or this past spring, right outside of Boca Grande, I heard about it within 2.5 hours of him hooking it. You know, he hooked it at like 6:30, and I was getting the video at I think 8 o'clock, 8:30.
Yeah.
You know, from a friend who was his friend.
Yeah. His friend's quick, and you don't even know the guy, or don't even have social media ties with him.
No clue whatsoever.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. That's how it spreads rapidly.
Right. And if there was any
good things and bad things with social media.
Yeah, I know. There's pros and cons to everything. Yeah. Is there if there was one shark you could target right now and basically, if you had the opportunity to target anything in this whole world, what shark would it be?
In this whole world?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. I mean, there's three sharks that are super high on my wish list of sharks to catch. One is a salmon shark.
Okay.
Two would be a tiger shark.
Uh-huh.
And three would be a mako.
Wow.
Those are kind of the top three in my
In that
wish.
Order?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, honestly.
Wow.
I mean, just because, I mean, large sharks are getting rarer and rarer, and unfortunately the salmon sharks are getting rarer and rarer up there. I'd want to target one of those
first,
if I had the opportunity first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and tiger sharks, obviously, you got those worldwide, so finding the right location for them. And then makos are even a little bit more difficult, but I'd be happy with a 4-foot tiger and a 4-foot mako. I wouldn't care. Say I caught one would be awesome.
I totally agree, because I would love to just see a mako in person, because I know of, like, I haven't seen one yet, but I know, like, the blues, the hues of the blues on them
has
got to be, like, unbelievable to see, since they're, like, a pelagic shark.
Exactly.
Seeing the stripes on a tiger up, you know, in person was just, that made it my favorite shark because it was so pretty.
Absolutely. So, you know, and we're just so lucky to have all the different species we have.
Yeah.
So it's always good to dream about some of the different sharks.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't even touch on anything really.
Well, that means we'll have to do a part two with you, Robert.
Sounds good.
Well, thanks for coming on today, Robert. And this is Tarpon World Radio. If you guys want, I would love to connect with you guys. Send me an email at tarponworld@gmail.com. Send me any questions you have or topics you'd like me to discuss. And we'll see you next week.